Hello, Indigenous Earthlings. Here we are again, 35 revolutions later, balancing into another Express Yourself. I'm Luke Nessler. And somebody pointed out that a day or a week, a day is not a revolution, but a rotation. But I don't know. Revolution sounds better than rotation, don't you think? Anyway, I am Luke, and yes, I'm back. Happy First Friday. I'm excited to be back sitting in the hot seat for Express Yourself because, again, I get to talk to accomplished and articulate artists. It's a great job, but somebody has to do it. So here I am. Thank you for tuning in. Well, today the spotlight falls on Deb Jones and Lori Doctor, two artists who are featured in the new exhibit at the Launchpad, Correspondence, which opens in 2 hours with a reception for the artists. Both women, with long and accomplished careers in the arts, found value in making work for this exhibit. We'll start with Deb, whom I spoke to yesterday, and then we'll hear from Lori, with whom I spoke by telephone from Taos this morning. Well, Deb Jones joins the program now. Hi, Deb. How are you?
Hi, Luke. Hi, everyone.
Deb,
excited to be here talking to you.
Well, I'm excited to have you because you're part of the exhibition opening tonight over at the Launchpad called Correspondence. Tell me about it. What is the concept of this exhibition?
Well, I am one of the initiating artists, and the curator, Raina Katzenberger, brought us together to do this collaborative process, which culminates in the exhibition itself. But it really is a journey of corresponding to one another, these partner artists, via the postal system. And, you know, sort of this physical exchange, but also this intimacy and story, writing back and forth to one another and having that be the only communication that you have. And, I mean, part of the concept is reminding us about slowing down, about non-electrical, non-digital, about a movement, the Fluxus movement, which was back in the early 60s, and the idea of mail art, of sending art through another kind of system where you're audience was unknown and random in a sense. So that's part of what was going on here.
Did you set any ground rules beforehand? I mean, first let's specify your partner artist was Lori Doctor. Were you aware of Lori Doctor prior to this? Did you know her? And did you put up any ground rules beforehand about this process?
So Lori Doctor is a pretty special person in my life. She actually is my teacher in terms of my art career and art process. And I brought her here to the Roaring Fork Valley maybe in 2005 when I was directing the Wiley Community Arts Center, which is now the Art Base, brought Lori, who is an amazing calligrapher and painter, had been in Boulder for 30 years and then moved to Kentucky. And she came here and taught and is just really exceptional for me in terms of understanding what it means to do daily practice and to be true to your own art making. I knew her, and we're friends and colleagues and are in touch with one another during the year because I'll take a class from her or I'll help her come and put a class together. And so we did sit down together in October once I'd become an initiating artist, and I asked her if she would be willing to do this process with me. And so we did sit down and do ground rules, probably different than some of the other artists that people are going to see in the exhibition. We did put together, decided on sort of a monthly rhythm that we would, one person would send, the other would respond, within sort of a 2-week period. We got organized, and we also did a format. We did a 7x7 format. We also chose to exchange our discoveries in the natural world together, and that we would go out into our woods or our locale where we are, she in the Kentucky woods and me up on Basalt Mountain at the end of a rural road where I live, and we would communicate to one another about our being in that space. And again, really absent of, when working in the studio on the piece, no electronic equipment and being very focused. Honoring her, the way that she sets up her classes and her working. So that's what we did, and they're really interesting sort of fold-out 7x7s that the viewer will see, writing along with imagery. Laura's a beautiful calligrapher, and that's really an exceptional part of her pieces.
I see. So you would receive a piece that Lori made, and you would contemplate that, and you would go out into your woods and contemplate that and fashion a response. And
yes.
And then you would send that to her, and then she would repeat that process at her end.
Yes. Then we did that over 7 months.
7 months. Huh. So it spanned the seasons. You were it wasn't just a summertime thing. It was more than that.
No, we started in October, and so it actually really does talk about the seasons. And so it was interesting for me, Luke, because it wasn't like I was writing my best friend a letter about what was going on, like in my family, in my relationships, health-wise. It was a little bit more ethereal and talking about discovery and observation. So we did get, I probably got maybe a little bit more personal, and even towards the end, I mean, it'll be interesting for me to hear what viewers think about the last piece that we did, which is really quite emotional and much more personal than the other pieces in the beginning.
Huh. So the visitor to the exhibition will see all the pieces that you and Lori exchanged chronologically.
Yes. Say that again.
Chronologically.
Yes, the curator Raina Katzenberger has set it up chronologically. So along with our pieces, there's going to be the pieces from the other artists in the show exhibited together, installed together, in a time timely. So you'll start with the month, and it'll be, I believe, displayed what month we're talking about, and move through the exhibition, which is not, you know, big, bright, easy to view art. It's really about reading and getting into the space of these artist exchanges.
Huh. Do you think you would have been able to produce the art you did if you had not known Lori beforehand?
If I had been working with an artist that I didn't know?
Yes.
Yes, I do think so, because I'm a practicing artist. And but, you know, that's a really good question, because for me, the intimacy and the exchange of story and knowing one another was certainly important in our process. And I think probably working with an artist that I didn't know, you would have watched the evolution of a relationship beginning.
Interesting. Now, did you produce these pieces in all media? Did you limit it to pastels or acrylics or whatever within that within that 7x7 format?
So, for me, I am a mixed media artist and a collage artist. So I did paint, different kinds of paint and some thread and torn paper, mixed media. very much like work, my work that I do elsewhere. And that was true for Laurie. She is a painter, and her medium really is the letter making and the development of different kinds of alphabets and the use of different kinds of instruments to make letters.
Huh. And all of that came into play for her.
Yes. Yes, it did.
I see.
And she's a beautiful artist. Her pieces, they would come in the mail. And for me, and we talked about this finally after May 1st, when we could speak again. And it was a fairly emotional conversation because it was the first time we were hearing each other's voice after those 7 months. And her pieces were so, I mean, I couldn't wait to get them. And she felt the same way. And when they'd come, my husband actually would get the mail and call me and say, "There's Laurie's piece, her next piece has come." It was a really great 7 months of getting these gifts, you know, once a month. I loved it.
So I imagine this did sort of slow you down, because it's not the instant digital world that we all know and sometimes hate these days.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, I mean, it was also this sort of feeling of going back to, you know, to the 1800s, how people operated before the telephone. But I think this kind of dialogue, you know, in retrospect, you take a look, and she and I have talked about this, of what our winter and our spring was like, what was going on in the other parts of our life. And this became a very important dialogue of simplicity and sort of clear and easy. And again, that intimacy part was important.
I see a part of this playing out as sort of a differing concept of what an audience for your art is. And in the making of this art, you were not making anything for a gallery audience. You were making something for one person.
And that's true. We had to be reminded by our curator, however, because we all knew that there would be an exhibition.
Okay.
And we were reminded to let go of the outcome, to really let go of the product. Now, that's a challenging thing to do for artists. Both Laurie and I are professional artists who have exhibited over the years. But I really had to get into that space where I had to get more playful with what I was doing and remind myself that, yes, I wanted to tell Laurie something, just her.
I'm intrigued by the idea that you had to get more playful. Talk more about that.
Well, I know for me that if I have a deadline and it is going to be, let's say, for an exhibition, and I am making the work knowing that it's going to be exhibited in such and such gallery or wherever, you know, I am influenced by what people will think constantly. And I like to be able to be in the studio and to not have that operating. And so actually for me as an artist in these last years, I have declined doing exhibitions because I am in a place now in my life where I have time to be in the studio. I'm no longer doing my community art center work, community art education, where I wanted to have this space to make work for the sake of making the work and not have this other pressure. Now, interesting enough, Luke, it's that I tend to be a little bit more prolific when I have some pressure and I have a deadline. So it's been a fascinating process to go through.
Wow.
To train myself.
That's really interesting. So did the work become a little more, dreamy as a result of that?
No, you know, my work, could be maybe more experimental. But no, I think that really I just have a more less sort of frantic approach to it and feel like I can experiment and do anything and try it out. You know, the work that I'm doing now in the studio happens to be about climate change in the Antarctica, and that's something that I'm very interested in, and I love all those. I'm so attracted to the images, the sort of horrifying images of the breakup of the glaciers. And so that's something I'm working on and really doing it over a long period of time and really trying to not feel the pressure, but really look at what is my connection and relationship with this theme.
Interesting.
It's not very greeny.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of my questions for you was going to be, did this process for correspondence, has it affected your artistic process or your inspiration? It sounds to me, based on what you've said, that the slam dunk answer is yes. And it sounds to me also that it's an incredible lesson that you learned. Do you think Lori learned that too?
Well, I think it just really substantiated the idea of doing practice in your life. Now, this isn't daily practice. This became sort of a bi-monthly practice. And that really does contribute to your nurturing your imagination and being in the studio. Mail art, for me, this idea of actually the mail and your posting of the artwork, getting those markings on there and the possible delay and the losses and that process of the mail art, I did mail art in the 70s, a lot of it. So that wasn't new for me, but it was really nice to come back to it because I hadn't done it for quite a while.
Well, from the outside looking in, I have to say it's rather heartening that mail art can still be relevant to an artist in a new millennium. That's incredible.
Yeah, and you know, I just need to do a bit of a shout-out to the post mistresses at the Basalt Post Office. They were lovely, and they were so accepting and really helped me because they do have they have more regulations than they did 30 years ago. And but they really worked with me, and they would comment on it. And, you know, I'm going to bring them I'm hoping that they're going to come to the opening and maybe at least come to the show this month. I'm going to make sure that I remind them about this exhibition. That was pretty great because I have worked with postal people who just really this process bothered them. You know, they it wasn't following the regulations.
So they were stretching out just as you and Lori were.
Yeah, I mean, they were very, very, so very nice about it.
Oh, that's great. I was perusing your website, DeborahJonesArt.com. That's Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, JonesArt.com. You mentioned process a little bit earlier. You're big on process. I noticed that you do a morning journal practice, a daily practice. Is that something that you had from the beginning, or did you discover that along your artistic way?
That particular, the morning journal process and my making that special hand-bound journal, I've been doing every morning for 2.5 years.
Oh.
And that really does come from my working with Lori Doctor and having her as my teacher. Though I had worked with her for many, many years, and she was always talking about this idea of doing a daily practice where you come to your art and you don't have other stimulus, and you really do let go of outcome, and she does really include a lot of writing in her process. And so I, 2.5 years ago, before I left the country and I went to India for a month, I decided that that trip to India was a good time to start. And so I do write. I cover my writing a lot with the paint. And then I do make a specific mark, which is the same mark each day, which for me is a symbol of balancing mind, body, spirit. And sometimes I'm really good and not distracted, Luke. And other mornings, I get up from my chair a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the intention to have those artistic artifacts, those morning daily journals, as something that is for sale? Or is this just a personal thing that you do to get ready to produce the art that you make your living from?
You know, it is really very, it's personal. They're not for sale, though I do, in collaboration with the project shop in Carbondale, I've made an edition of blank morning journals with a description of Lori's idea of morning practice. And those are for sale blank for people to do that process. But these journals are mine, and my poor children will have to do something with them one day.
I'm talking to you today because you are paired up with Deb Jones in the Correspondence Exhibition, which opens tonight with a reception here in Carbondale. And we gathered from Debbie kind of what the whole concept of the Correspondence Exhibition is. I'm wondering how it worked for you. How did it affect your ongoing artistic process or your inspiration? What were the ramifications of the Correspondence Exhibition?
Well, Deb invited me to do it. And I immediately said yes without really thinking it through. And then wondered at what I'd gotten myself into. And then was just so delighted about how much it added to my experience as a visual and verbal lover of image and words, that this process of having to wait, because we couldn't indulge in any kind of social media, phone, email, nothing, that we really limited ourselves to only these things we sent by post, there was this forced opportunity to have to be patient, which we've pretty much removed the need for patience or boredom, both of which actually feed the creative process, because I find myself saying to my students, for example, if you haven't done something long enough to get bored, you haven't gone for far enough. There's something on the other side of that, but we live in a world that wants to rush to the end. So it eliminated the possibility of rushing to the end. I would write and send images, and then I had to wait. So there was a corresponding deepened sense of delight when something came back, and the attention to every word, and the power that it had, because it was held in that structure where that was all that was allowed. I thought, well, the phone was invented in the 1850s, maybe, Alexander Bell. So we were going back to a time before the phone.
Wow.
And that was just quite a lovely experience. And because Deb is also a friend, I think it deepened our relationship in ways we could not have imagined.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? I have a vision of two grown women standing beside the mailbox pining for a letter from a friend or a lover, just like a love-struck teenager from the 70s.
Exactly.
It's funny. Yeah. You know, Deb talked about her relationship with the postal clerks at the Basalt Post Office. And I thought she wanted to shout them out because evidently you guys violated a lot of postal regulations, which I thought
was... Oh, did we?
I thought that was kind of funny, but so you deferred your gratification quite a while there, didn't you? And
yeah, I mean, it's a paradox, and of course, part of our ability to grow as humans, I think, is the ability to hold paradox. But it is a paradox that in this case, delayed gratification leads to a much deeper, more lasting kind of fulfillment.
Huh. I guess it gave
that's
you...
That's covered over.
I see. Well, I was going to say, I guess it gave you a lot of time to be surprised once you finally got what you were expecting, or maybe not expecting, from Deb.
Well, and we did have a structure. She probably mentioned that. We had the structure since she lives in the Colorado woods and I live in the Kentucky woods. We had a structure for our correspondence around time each week without even a camera or anything in our woods to notice and be curious, find out about what's there. And a corresponding amount of time in our studio that was also uninterrupted by any little dings or dongs.
That's a good way to put it. Well, gathering, yeah. You know, from what I gather from your website, this idea of slowing yourself down and entering into your process in a more conscious way isn't strange to you. That's something that you've shot for and longed for and practiced and achieved for a long time. So I wonder if this exercise, this exhibition here, the correspondence exhibition, if that exercise deepened your practice, and if so, how?
Well, one thing that comes to mind, for example, is even though I aspire in my walks in my woods, for example, not to bring my phone with me. Sometimes I do for taking pictures or because I'm feeling especially pressed upon that day. But the fact that Deb and I thought about it and agreed that we couldn't even bring a camera, what I noticed is that because of that, I would stay with something longer. That observation deepened of something. There was a different kind of attention it required of me because I couldn't just snap it. And that I enjoyed too. I think I made discoveries that I would not have made otherwise.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh. And how do you intend to carry that forward in your into your art in the future?
Well, I'm a you know, being like I wish to be, in other words, I wish to, as William Stafford said, welcome whatever comes, which is easier said than done. And to do that, there's a kind of openness that's required. And that kind of openness takes water, like a plant. So it deepened my conviction that it actually does make a difference that I make time to walk, to notice, and even though I feel very busy, to at least some of the time leave my phone behind, for example.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
What I've found over and over again, because I began
I guess you could say, my career as a self-employed artist and teacher as a single mom in Boulder, Colorado, and I didn't have the luxury of being fluffy about it. But what I noticed was when I followed that conviction to make time when I didn't have time, it always expanded time. So that whatever I had going on that felt so pressing opened up a little. So I'm a real believer in that.
Yeah.
It's counterintuitive way of operating.
And also, you're well acquainted with paradox, it sounds to me like.
Oh, yeah. We're all paradoxes, aren't we?
Yeah. And I guess that's a deep well in terms of artistic expression.
Paradox?
Yes. And that idea, yes. that idea of what? Unifying a whole that maybe isn't immediately apparent?
Right. Or even allowing the paradox to be. I think even with paradox, we want to rush to unity, or I know I do sometimes, but I think the value is in allowing it to be, and that happens over and over again in the creative pattern, because that's why all the stories, all the creation stories all over the world begin in the dark, and there was darkness upon the face of the deep. There aren't any creation stories that I've ever run across that say in the beginning it was light. It requires us to start over and over and over again with the paradox of darkness and not knowing where we are, what we're doing, who we are, you know. Another word that's more popular for that, I guess, is beginner's mind.
But. Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, that's a pretty deep well. You know, I look at a lot of your work on your website, and I notice the presence of alphabets, sometimes hieroglyphic in nature. Other times it almost looks like you could hold a mirror to it if you wanted to read it. What is your fascination with that? Tell me.
In my particular case, it took me what I consider a long time to find my hands. It was after graduate school, and I was very academic. And my father's an inventor, and I was good in math like him. So art had no place in my life. But when I took my first calligraphy class, quote, unquote, by accident, I ended up in this class. It was like, oh my gosh. It was such a sense of coming home. And then I realized, well, of course, you know, I've been writing. That's the one thing I always did do. I was the child that wrote pages and pages of letters over and over. When I learned to write, my memory, anyway, is that I wrote beautiful letters. I loved making shapes. I loved writing. I always kept journals. I kept diaries. But at a very young age, probably 10 or so, I realized, at least my felt sense was, that my mother was reading my diary. So I began making up codes. That's probably where it goes back to. But now what I find as a calligrapher and understanding that families of letters that belong together have certain design and architectural principles that make them work together, there's that part of it. But then there's also the part that when I, quote, memorize one of these alphabets I've made up and begin writing in that, it's as if you wander into a different country in your brain. I'm sure it's a part of the brain that doesn't get used that much, but there's some quality about writing in an alphabet that we don't know that takes you somewhere else. And then it's just responding to this almost visceral draw I feel toward writing. Even if I'm in an exhibit of painting and there are sketchbooks around, or the process that got a painter toward that, that's where I go. Or if I'm at the British Museum in London, I can't seem to get out of the Egyptian room, which has just walls of old ancient writing. So I'm very drawn to that.
Uh-huh.
And when I paint, I carry around a sketchbook where I am here right now, and I love drawing what I see in a, you know, representational kind of way. But when I get to the canvas or painting, I'm really, I lose interest in being representational. I come from the inside out. I have to find the painting, which takes a ridiculous amount of time sometimes, much longer for me than if I'm looking at something and trying to represent it. So in those paintings, and they come from more the liminal places or the dream world, sometimes I'm compelled to put some kind of writing, but I don't want it to be representational either.
Why?
Because I don't want to fix the meaning of the painting. I want to leave room for the imagination.
Okay.
And for the exchange that happens between the painter and the observer of the painting. There's a dialogue that can happen. If you leave room for the mystery in a piece of work, it's the same in a poem. If you leave room for the mystery, you invite participation. Hmm. You invite the viewer to participate in the painting. And also, the painting, if it has depth, it doesn't stay the same every time you go back to it. And if it has depth and that kind of resonance, you are drawn back to it over and over again. So that's what I'm interested in.
Interesting. Well, you talk on your website and on one of your blogs, you say, I see a work of art not as a thing in itself, but as a door that opens both ways, out into the world and inward to your soul. So that's exactly what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah, sounds like it.
You know, I guess... It's really interesting to me how something that you can't read can actually inscribe on your soul a message. And there's we're talking about paradox. There's a paradox right there, right in front of our faces.
Yes.
Right there. There it is.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Did you get onto that early on in your artistic career, or is this something you discovered?
Very early.
Huh.
Very early. And now it's almost becoming... it's the danger of anything, you know. Now it's almost becoming more of a thing, I think.
Oh, so it's time to change,
it's,
huh?
It's well, you just have to be brave enough, I think, to become more and more who you are and not worry too much about what's a thing or what isn't a thing. If it comes from, as you said, that deep well, that's true. And what people want to see is what's true. It doesn't mean that there isn't some value as a poet or a painter or a calligrapher in imitation. That's part of the learning process. But in the end, you have to keep traveling with something long enough that it becomes your own. And there's always the danger of trends in culture that look, what would the word be? Facile's not quite the right word. That look seductive, springy, happening, shiny,
okay,
glittery.
Uh-huh.
That's we are susceptible to that kind of seduction, but as long as we just have that be one of the stepping stones, no problem there.
What you're talking about, Lori, in the practice of the art is antithetical to the commercial aspect of things. I mean, presumably you're making these things for a market, and I'm wondering if it's difficult for you or anyone to practice that ethic in that kind of, with that kind of constraint. How do you deal? How do you deal with the marketplace?
That's a really, really good question. And people handle that in all kinds of different ways. But the decision that I made for myself, as seductive as it may seem sometimes to be want to be part of the 30 seconds of fame commodified world of art, where really on that level a gallery can decide they want to make something of someone like they did with Basquiat and market it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're a production machine. And so I just decided for myself, well, that's not what I want to do. I want the freedom to keep painting how I paint, which is not saying that it's a great way to paint.
Right.
But to just honor how it is that I do it, which both means I don't know what's going to happen and perhaps it'll take longer. And I've had the good fortune of galleries finding me and supporting that way of operating.
Do you think they found you because you held fast to that principle?
I don't know. I think they found me because there were some people, even if there were only one or two, that resonated with my work. And, you know, I got recommended that way.
Okay. Interesting.
A lot happens by word of mouth,
okay,
still.
Uh-huh.
In this electronic world. There's a lot that goes on with that personal physicality of seeing something or someone.
Well, that's heartening.
Yeah. I don't think it can be replaced with anything, actually.
Well, I guess it's because you're in the business of making an object, and you can't, you know, you don't understand an object until you're in front of it or holding it or, you know, observing it.
Yeah, and I hope I'm that it's not only about that, but
mm-hmm.
something bigger, like wanting to stay close to the mystery or not keeping death far away, or the mystery of where we came from and where we're going, and that you know, when you don't keep that far away, there's a kind of aliveness in really everything that happens.
Wow, what an incredible place to conclude our little conversation, Lori Doctor. Thank you so much. As always, when I talk to an engaged artist, I feel like I could talk for hours. There's so much to explore. That was Lori Doctor, and before that, Deb Jones, two of the artists involved in the new Carbondale Arts exhibit at the Launchpad. If you missed any of these conversations, please visit kdnk.org, and you'll find them right there on the homepage. Stay with us. More to come on today's Express Yourself. Thank you.
From the late days of summer, when western winds blow dry, to the bright light of winter and the spring river rise. Mountains to the prairies, the places I have grown, only a small glories, thinking about my home. Home.
That's a little taste of the Small Glories from their 2016 CD, Wondrous Traveler, a tune called Home. The Small Glories are a Canadian duo, Kara Luft and J.D. Edwards. You may remember Kara as a member of the Waylon Jennies. The Small Glories visit Steve's Guitars tomorrow night. Well, the potential demise of the Glenwood Springs Center for the Arts has been in the headlines lately. The bad news has inspired an effort by the community to save it, and the outpouring of support already is heartening and notable. Your next chance to support the center and its work of knitting together our community through the arts is next Friday. And here to tell us about that are Sandy Haber. Welcome, Sandy.
Thank you.
Brad Verheller is here, too. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
Paul Valentine is here.
Hi.
And Doug Whitney.
Hello.
We'll get to both of those gentlemen. They are holding down the musical end of this potential, or not potential, it's happening, isn't
it's
it?
It's a gala.
It's a gala. Don't you love galas?
All out.
a gala Glenwood Springs style.
At the
That's
Glenwood
right.
Vaudeville.
So let's just touch briefly before we get into the actual event. Is the Glenwood Springs Center for the Arts going down? Is it going to stick around?
Yes, it is. It's sticking around. It is rising from its ashes.
Nice.
The doors are open and they're offering dance camps through the summer.
Oh, so the Dancers Dancing event, the recent one, is not the swan song.
No, it is not.
Yay.
Yay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
those kids get to keep on dancing. And the younger ones, too, get to start up.
Kids of all ages dancing, right?
That's right.
And isn't that what the Center of the Arts is all about?
And it is. It's always publicized as for the kids, but there are so many adults that come to evening classes. Pottery, jewelry making, painting is really popular with Terry Muldoon and Noemi Kosmoski, two amazing fine artists. So it's not only about the kids. We'd love more adults to be involved, too.
And it's also about clay and music, guitar lessons and piano lessons.
How long has the Center for the Arts been around?
It's over 25 years
wow.
now. And in fact, at the benefit gala next week, Terry Glassenep, who is retired from CMC, was one of the original founders of the Council for the Arts 25 years ago that turned into the Center for the Arts. And he'll be speaking for just a few minutes about the history.
Well, KDNK listeners are very familiar with Terry. He's been a DJ on KDNK since just about day one.
Well, then come on down and say hi.
So where is this gala? Tell us about it.
Well, this gala is going to be at the Glenwood Vaudeville Theater. Downtown Glenwood, John Goss, the owner, has been very generous to give us a theater at no charge so that the full ticket price for the event can go to the center. Tickets are tax deductible. And a week from tonight, Friday, June 9th, the doors will open at 6. And what your ticket price includes is this amazing band, who two of the musicians are sitting here with us, Nanama. Jazz fusion, high caliber, world-class music. You don't want to miss this. This is going to be a concert worth the ticket price alone. We also have live painting by the Kosmoskis. There will be vaudeville skits. We have three different dance performances by some of the highly skilled dancers. There's a comedy act, and we have amazing live and silent auction items. The community's been very generous, and just as an example, we have from a $960 valued amethyst geode.
I heard that was 27
pounds. It's 27 pounds. It's
Yikes.
Really a beauty.
How about that?
We've got condos in Moab. We've got the Redstone Inn. We have golf at the Snowmass Club. We even have something a little unusual for an auction. We have $750 worth of licensed electrical work by David Electric. Shane David was so nice to give that to us. We have lots of gift certificates for restaurants and facials and spas, for piano and voice lessons with Brad here, who's one of the teachers at the center. We have a beautiful vintage glass-balled Christmas wreath that was made by somebody in Carbondale. We've got spray tans. We've got gift certificates for Jim's Automotive. We've got jellies, jams, sophisticated syrups, and more.
How about that? Isn't it amazing what a community can come up with when the chips are down, Brad?
It is. And we should talk more about the live auction, too, because the Kosmowskis, Noemi and Christoph, will be painting during all of the show and the band and everything. And then at the end, the live auction will feature these paintings being auctioned off. So that's really going to be fun because the art will come to life before your eyes.
Now, are people able to place bids on these auction items beforehand, or is that happening the evening of the gala?
It's happening the evening of the gala. Okay. It is possible that people will be able to bid by phone.
Okay.
We don't have all the mechanics of that worked out yet, but that is a possibility.
And can people purchase tickets ahead of time, or is it only at the door?
Nope. Tickets are available currently at Glenwood Music up by Walmart, at Rivers Restaurant, at Deja Brew, which is in between the 7-Eleven and the ice cream store in Glenwood, and at High Country Gems and Minerals, also known as The Rock Shop, on 8th Street.
That's great.
And you can also purchase tickets by going to glenwoodarts.org if you'd like to do credit card sales.
Okay.
For tables of six or more, we can arrange a reservation so you can all sit together.
Let's talk a little bit about the music. Nanama is the band. You guys are recently formed, aren't you, Doug and Paul?
Yeah, we've been together about a year or so. Since we got back from Texas, and it's been a real quick journey. First thing we did was start recording an album. We figured we'd learn the songs inside out, or backwards anyway. We'd record first and then learn to play them live, and that's we came out with a real nice product. I believe it's fun and refreshing for us anyway.
Uh-huh. Indeed.
Huh. Jazz fusion. Tell me more.
Oh.
You want to take that one?
It's
a wonderful, there's not a genre of music that we don't wander into and wander back out of and kind of stir around with something else and play one kind of vibe underneath a contrary vibe, but it's very melodic. It's not, you know, as exploratory as it is, it's still very, very appealing in my mind anyway. So
okay.
I hope people enjoy it.
That's great. Are you already gigging around the valley, Paul?
Well, no, this is going to be our debut live performance.
How about that? That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the stage at Vaudeville is really nice.
It's
a very intimate venue. I think it's a great place to see live music.
Great sound system.
Yes.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Looking forward to that.
And I saw John Rigger at the Hot Springs Pool the other day, and he said that all of your material is original. So that's really exciting.
That is exciting. Yeah.
And what is your website? Because I remember going to it and listening to clips, and I was really, really impressed.
The website is, go ahead.
Well, it's nanamaquartet.com.
It's N-A-N-A-M-A, quartet, Q-U-A-R-T-E-T.com.
And where did you come up with that name?
The name goes way back, but we've had a Ute friend, my wife and I, for quite a while. We've done a lot of work. He's a Northern Ute elder, and he started a foundation, and we got the name from him. He called it Nanama, and that was a Ute word for all together as one, creator, nature, and man. So that's the way he looked at things in the hierarchy, and that's the kind of the reason we're all together playing this music, and we're all of like heart and like mind, so it's only natural that we should start off with a benefit for the local arts.
I was just going to say, how appropriate is that? That's perfect.
For us to all come together.
Yes,
to
it is.
Help recreate and make it better than before, the Center for the Arts.
So if anyone needs more information, Sandy, how can they get it beforehand?
They can get information by going to www.glenwoodarts.org. You can also call, and if nobody answers the phone, you can leave a message. And my name and phone number actually was printed on the tickets for more information, and that number is 970-379-7138.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming in and telling us about it, and I salute your efforts to support the arts in Glenwood Springs.
Thank you.
Thank you. Come on down. Live art.
Well, as it happens, Nanama just laid their brand new CD in my hands, so let's go out with a little taste of Nanama, which you'll hear a week from tonight at the Vaudeville Theater in Glenwood Springs. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.